the back table and you'll be given a number. And that will tell you when your place is in the line of the speakers. We are limiting speakers to 5 minutes. And if there are more speakers than we have, considering the amount of time we will limit people to 3, but I don't think that's going to be necessary at this hearing. So we will take a 5 to 10 minute break at approximately 8 o'clock. So that we don't all get to sit idle, which I'm sure some of us will experience. This is the first in a series of 12 public hearings that will be held around the state of Minnesota. The hearing is being taped, so public testimony will be available to our record so that we can refer to it when we start writing our report. I would like to ask if there are any members of the legislature present at this time. If there are, I would like you to stand up and introduce yourself. If not, then we will introduce ourselves. My name is Barry Sell. I am the task force chair. I live in Minneapolis. I'm a mother of 6 children. I've been active in community affairs and particularly school affairs for a long time. I'm a member of the Minneapolis Public Schools Aid Task Force and a parent member of the state. And I was named to this task force, as the rest of us were, in April of this year, April of 1990. We held our first meeting in May of 1990, and the task force does self-destruct on the Monday before the legislature opens, the first Monday of January, the task force is officially open. What we are doing is holding these 12 public hearings, and then we will get together and write a report in which we will make recommendations to the legislature about the quality of life of gays and lesbians in Minnesota. We invite your testimony. If you have not signed up to say something and midway through you decide, I guess I'd really like to get up there and say something, please go back and sign the sheet. There's plenty of times for everybody to be heard. If you do not want to speak publicly, but you would like to have a testimony, we'll be happy to accept that. And there's also, on the guideline sheet which you received, at the bottom of the page is the telephone number for the Department of Human Rights. If anybody would like to call, you can use the 800 number and leave a message for me, and I will return your call if you would like to do that as well. With that, I will ask the other members of the task force who are here to introduce themselves.
My name is Leo Treadway. I'm vice chair for the task force, and I chair the committee for hearings and briefings. We are the ones who have brought you this interview tonight. I will probably self-destruct before January.
Somebody that can do it.
I'm Brian Ritchie. I'm with the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. I spend most of my time lobbying over at the Capitol. I represent the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the Minnesota Council of Churches, and the Jewish Community Relations Council. I serve on the Legal Issues Subcommittee and the Religious Relations Subcommittee of this conference.
My name is Ed Flavin. I'm the Catholic priest of the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis. And I chair in the task force, the subcommittee on religious affairs and religious community. Otherwise, for a living, I'm a jail chaplain in the next county. I work in the jails and workhouses of St. Paul, right in the next county. And I'm an employee in that capacity in the diocese and not the church panel.
For those people who are standing, there are a couple of chairs in the first row over here, and there are a couple of chairs at that table if you would like to sit down. There are a couple of comfortable chairs behind that table. We're sitting on these kinds of chairs, so we know they are comfortable. Very comfortable. Chris, do you have the names of the people who are going to sit?
Number one, Jim Hope.
Okay, I guess what I was going to do tonight is try to give the the task force a little bit of insight to what gay life has been in the Rochester area, probably since the modern gay movement, which kind of started in 1968 with the Stonewall.
I interrupt you and ask you to identify yourself for the record, your name, address, and could you spell your last name?
My name is Jim Helget. The last name is H-E-L-G-E-T, 628 4th Street, Southwest Rochester. I moved to Rochester in 1971, and going back, I remember at that time there being no organized gay community in Rochester. There was a small group of gay males, probably 30 to 40, who did a certain amount of socializing together. And about the only organized social activity at that time was an occasional party. About 1974 or 1975, we felt that there really needed to be some type of gay or lesbian organization in Rochester. And so we formed a very loose-knit group called Lambda Friends. We had no money to work with, so about all we could afford was to put our name out to the public. And that was basically so that people who were interested in any gay or lesbian issues or felt that they wanted to make contact with our group, that they would have a place to turn to. That organization lasted about 6 years till 1980. During the entire 1970s, we did not know any lesbians in Rochester. Occasionally we would get an inquiry. As soon as they found out that there were no other women in the group, they seemed to disappear back in the woodwork. In 1980, we were approached by someone who offered us an opportunity to be a little bit more ambitious about our community. And thus we started Gay Lesbian Community Services, which is still active today. Our first meeting, I think we had maybe somewhere between 20 and 30 people. And I guess to our surprise, suddenly all these women came out of the woodwork, and we had a pretty much 50-50 organization. Basically, our organization in Rochester in the past 10 years has existed as support for the gay and lesbian community and the resource for gay and lesbian people's families, their friends, or for the public at large. The kinds of services we offer is we do have a phone line which is open twice a week for anyone who has concerns about gay or lesbian issues. It's not just for gay and lesbian people, it's for anyone who would like to call, needs information, support, referral, or whatever. We do offer referrals in terms of whatever the caller's needs, if they feel that they need some professional help, whether it be religious, legal, psychological, or we try to meet whatever need that or requests that they have. We have done some community awareness. Most of that has been done at Rochester Community College and various other groups with which we've been invited to speak. And our speaking is all centered around sexual orientation issues. We have a small library which has some novels, it has reference material, different kinds of materials that you would probably not be able to access in the public library. dealing with sexual orientation. We did not organize to be a political organization. We have never been that, although we do try to keep our community aware of things that happen in the political areas that affect our community. Let's see, we also do have a monthly newsletter that goes out, which is a basic organizational newsletter that just keeps everyone informed of our activities. We also did not organize to be a social organization. However, we found that in Rochester, who still in 1990 does not have a public place for gay people to meet in a comfortable setting, that there was a need for someone to take some leadership in the social area. And so we have provided some social opportunities and events to help meet that.
Are there any questions?
I have a follow-up question to your last comment. With regards to a public place for gay and lesbian people in Rochester, what sort of place would you like to see, and what obstacles would there be to establish?
Well, we really haven't discussed that a great deal. We, you know, most communities, the standard place is a gay bar. Certainly that would be nice, but we aren't necessarily as a group, necessarily want a place that would necessarily serve alcohol. That's not a priority for us. We would like some kind of place like a coffee house or somewhere where people could just stop in. Through our calls at the service, we oftentimes get people who are traveling through town, and there are a great number of people who travel through this town. They're here 2 or 3 days. They're either here on business, or more likely they are here to visit Mayo Clinic. Many people come bringing their elderly parents to the clinic, and they just need a place to go and unwind and relax with people that they can relate to. Unfortunately, we have to tell them there is no place that we can even suggest to them. If they're here on a long term, of course, we can get them involved in activities of the group, but on the short term, it's really very difficult, and there is a need for it. In terms of obstacles, I don't know, I guess the biggest obstacle is we need someone who can take the initiative to do this. The core group of volunteers already struggle with burnout just keeping the organization going. If it were in terms of, say, a bar, that I think the cost here in Rochester and the likelihood of getting a liquor license and starting a bar is very unrealistic. It's expensive to start a bar here, and it's also they do limit the number of liquor licenses they're willing to give out. So the only other alternative to starting a bar would be to kind of take over one that already exists, but that really hasn't, we haven't really zeroed on a place that would be workable even.
Does your gay lesbian community services have any outside funding other than what members might contribute from philanthropic churches in United Way?
When we started, there was a private source that got us started. Currently, everything that we spend, which is not a great deal, we raise ourselves, mostly through the dances that we sponsor every other month during the winter months. And that's been enough to just keep us going.
And the second question is, do you feel like you have a regional constituency, or is it pretty much folks that live in the city of Rochester?
Oh, no, it's definitely southeastern Minnesota, because there's really no opportunities for people unless they go as far as La Crosse, Wisconsin, or Minneapolis to the north.
You know, and do you think that if we had a public place like the coffee house, that would work?
Well, certainly it would make us more visible and would, you know, certainly would probably give people more of an opportunity to be in a situation where that could happen. But I think in general, if we had a place and it was properly run and it was not a place that causes trouble and so forth, I think the community would probably more or less just realize it's there and would not bother with it.
Mm-hmm.
Mary Wallace.
My name is Mary Wallace, W-A-L-L-A-C-E. I live at 3118 Noel Lane, Northwest, here in Rochester. I am a member of Gay Lesbian Community Services, but my testimony does not have any specific bearing on that organization. My testimony is geared toward one request that you people make at the end of your deliberations, and that is to ask that some form of homophobia training be instituted in all the junior and senior public high schools in this state. Here's the reason why I asked that. About 10 years ago or so, my son, who was then a senior in one of Rochester's public high schools, would come home, now this is a senior, 17 years old, like to bug mom, would come home and say, "Hey mom, you want to hear the fag joke that Mr. So-and-so told in class today?" And I would say, well, he knew my involvement with the gay lesbian community, so it was a way of sort of torment mother. And I would say, he didn't really use that language. And he would say, my son said, "Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And you want to hear the joke?" And of course, I would be subjected to whatever today's joke was. Now, this went on for a number of days, a number of times, and about the third time, I just couldn't stand it anymore. I said, you know, he doesn't really say this in class, does he? Gets a bunch of guys off later. No, tells him right in class. Well, fortunately, the parent-teacher conferences were coming up, and I had an opportunity to talk with this teacher. And I went and sat down with him, and I said, "Mr. So-and-so," I said, "my son really thinks you're a terrific teacher." And he smiled a lot. I said, "He takes a lot of, he takes in what you say in class and your attitudes, and he's really appreciates what you have to say." And he smiled a lot. And I said, "And that's why I think it's real important that I let you know the kind of attitudes that you're conveying." I said, after building him up on purpose, I said, "Can you tell me in that case, is it true that you use the word fag in class?" And he went up and up and up and up. And he, "Well, maybe." I said, "Oh, could you tell me in what regard did you use the word fag in the high school class?" And he said, "I think it was on a unit on civil rights." And I said, "Oh, did you also use the words nigger, kike, etc.?" And he looked at me in horror. And he said, "Well, no, of course not." And I said, "Yes, of course not. If you'd had a black kid sitting in your classroom, you would never have used the word nigger in front of that child. You don't know how many gay or lesbian young people are sitting in your classroom struggling with their sexual identity, or who will be soon struggling with their sexual identity, and the kind of attitude and impression that you are instilling not only in them but in their classmates is the reason why they have such negative ideas about themselves." And I was just horrified. I said, "Under no circumstances should that kind of language be used. You can't name a circumstance that would permit that kind of language and attitude to be given to the kids. Oh, well, the kids, I mean, they like the jokes. I said, you know, you're the adult person here. You know, I just won't tolerate that kind of language. Well, this story, of course, was told to me only by my son, and I didn't feel that I could follow up immediately. However, shortly thereafter, a week or so thereafter, my son came home one day from school, and he said to me, "I don't want you to talk to any more of my teachers." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "Mr. So-and-so told all of his classes, except the one I'm in, that somebody's mother came up to him at the conferences and chewed him out for talking about the fags." And I talked to my friend so-and-so, and we figured it had to be you. It was about 20 minutes later that I was in the principal's office complaining to the principal about the kind of language and the kind of attitude and the flip sense that this teacher had about who people are and what you can say about them. And I will say that the principal was not concerned about the use of language. The principal was very concerned about breaking the confidentiality of a parent-teacher conference, but nothing ever happened to my knowledge. Now, I just feel that kind of attitude in the schools cannot go on. Why our young people are infected with homophobia is because some of our teachers are, and we have to do something to be aware of that. Thank you.
Mayor, I'd like to follow up. I understand the thrust of what you're suggesting would be anti-homophobic training for school professionals. Would you see a similar need, perhaps as part of a broader curriculum focus for students as well?
Well, I think the idealist in me sees many additional offshoots of that. Certainly, I would like to see orientation as a part of sexual of education about sexuality from the earliest ages. I think that kids need to hear about and know about sexual orientation as just another piece of what sexuality is all about. Another place that I'm sure that the public schools would benefit would be if we could get rid of this archaic notion that gay and lesbian teachers have some negative influence on kids, and instead see that gay and lesbian teachers could instead be very positive role models for kids, and do away with the kind of attitude that makes coming out and being who you are in the classroom such a risk that you may lose your job, that there's no chance the very persons who could best instill positive, realistic ideas about sexuality and about being a real person are prohibited from doing so.
At this time, I would just like to remind people for the benefit of those who came in late. First of all, there are still some chairs over here in the family. Please feel free to come across and sit down. If you would like to speak and you have not signed in, please do so, and you will get a number which puts your future place in the line. Next speaker, please.
Jack Peddle.
My name is Reverend Jack Haddorff, H-A-D-D-O-R-F-F, 806 Church Avenue, St. Charles, Minnesota. My concerns have to do with three general areas. First area is safety. That is, my gay and lesbian friends do not find a feeling of safety in our culture, generally, and in this part of the world specifically. My second area of concern has to do with the loss of some of our best people from our communities to metropolitan areas, because those are the only areas that allow people to be who they are, or at least anonymous enough to be who they are authentically there. and I am concerned about that for this part of the world. And thirdly, as a minister of the gospel, I have read in history books about the way in which people used the Bible as a way of keeping blacks from having equal treatment in our culture, and the way in which the Bible was used and continues to be used to keep women from having their authentic place in our culture, and the way in which now the scriptures are used as a way of beating gay and lesbian people over the head. I think all of these three areas might be addressed by what Mary just suggested, by some homophobia training for both teachers and students, for police officers, for whomever. It seems to me a while back we had what was called human relations training for teachers. Did that include gay and lesbian issues? Or was it ethnic minorities, I believe, mostly? I would love to see something like that happen for a school teacher. We sit down and we talk about it. From my perspective, the scriptures, the folks that wrote the scriptures did not have in mind the idea of homosexuality as a psychosexual orientation. It was acts being committed by heterosexual people, and therefore they were unnatural acts, and therefore sinful. But they had no conception of the psychosexual orientation that 20th century minds considered.
I wonder if you might comment on the conversations that you've had with your colleagues, the Ministerial Alliance, or whatever you call it, characterizing things of coming, share your concerns and what possibilities there might be for some.
You're going to throw it right back in my lap, aren't you? I heard a priest say one day that he thought that clergy were a wonderful resource for gay and lesbian people to hear the pain and to empathize with the situation. And yet the church was one of the most hostile places toward gay and lesbian people. And I realized by asking me to clean up our cultural house, I am also recognizing my responsibility to help the church clean up its house too.
I'll tell me a little bit about the environment that you're operating. Is there a ministerial alliance?
Yes, yes. Yeah, there.
Openness to discussions about.
I'm talking about St. Charles, Minnesota, with 2,000 people. We're, you know, 8 churches, people that all live together. And we, we talk about issues like that. There's a lot of sympathy for the pain. There's some misunderstanding about what that's all about. There is, at least among these people, a willingness to look at Scripture in a more intelligent way than I've some places found. So all of those things lend to at least us feeling good about what we're doing and being open as individuals. To gay and lesbian people know how that translates to the community is another story.
I'd like to push a bit further on that if I could. I may have to help you with phrasing the question too. What I'm concerned about is what you would see, or you and your colleagues would see, as the appropriate role for the church regarding public policy issues in this area.
If th- on a theoretical basis, the role of the church is to be out in front leading, from my perspective. It's interesting that we talk a lot about, you know, crucifixions and allowing us to die for the good of humanity. And that sort of image is quite common in all denominations of Christianity, I think. And yet, when we start talking about doing that publicly, some clergy and some church leaders get very nervous about that. And whereas I would like to see the church leading, I fear the church is most often following.
Let me put that a bit further. It would come as no surprise to you, I suspect, that there are leaders within the religious community, certainly within the Christian community, that would articulate an argument that homosexuality is basically behavior which is chosen behavior, which is sinful, and sinful behavior which can be changed. Do you have any thought as to what relevance those comments have around issues of human rights protection?
For those people that would make that kind of statement? You think, are you implying in a hidden agenda that is used as a way of?
My understanding is that people who espouse that set of beliefs conclude that therefore there should not be special privileges granted to homosexuals. That's their language and the way they characterize this. I guess I would be interested in your reaction that line of reasoning and its relevance to public policy decisions for people who would not necessarily identify with those religious traditions in the first place.
Well, you're going to have to say it another way to me. I'm not understanding what you're wanting from me.
There are conservative religious leaders who feel that homosexuals should change.
Yes.
And that because they should change, no action needs to be taken regarding protection of their human rights. That process of change seems most often to look like a born-again experience. And I'm wondering where that belief crosses the line of appropriateness in terms of people who would not identify with a born-again experience or tradition, what that means in terms of their human rights.
I have not seen any data that can verify the assumption that they start from. That is, that this is something that we can change. All we have to do is A, B, C, D. I have not seen any data that says that can happen. And until I do, you know, I have a hard time dealing with them. They say it as a faith statement, and I guess, you know, in this culture, when people say things, no matter how little they can justify them in terms of any kind of data, that needs to be their faith statement. But in terms of working out public policy, my hope is you and the legislature would deal with the data and what that says about who people are.
Do we have other people who have signed us to speak? Is there anyone else who would like to sign? Would you please sign in and then come forward? For those of you who are just joining us, if you would like to speak tonight, please sign in and we'll get a space on your agenda. We're limiting speaking time 5 minutes, however, I'm not holding that exactly because we don't seem to have a huge number of people who want to speak.
Jerry, I would suggest that since we have so many people who came in since we started, that perhaps a reintroduction would be in order and a little recap of the work of the task force.
I think we can do this again, those of you who were here in the beginning, please bear with us. We are members of the Government Task Force, I'm Dan and Leslie and myself. The task force was appointed by Governor Christmas in April of 1998, for the first time in the middle of May. The task force self-destructs on the first Monday of January, which is the day before the legislative session opens. And I will ask also, are there any legislators who have come in and completed the job? So I do have to introduce you. There are 14 members on the task force. I am the chair. My name is Jerry Bell. I am a Minneapolis resident, active in my community, and particularly in tourism. So I spent 24 years as a Minneapolis public school parent. So I do get involved. I am the parent member of the Minneapolis public school aid task force as well. And I will let my colleagues introduce themselves.
My name is Ed Flavin. I'm a Catholic priest in the Archdiocese of St. Paul, Minneapolis. And I'm a jail chaplain in Ramsey County, St. Paul. Previous to that, I was pastor of a church called St. Stephen's in South Minneapolis for 12 years. So we have a very significant population for the rest of the people in the teams and in the parish leadership.
I'm Brian Ruscha. I'm the executive director of the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. We're an interfaith social justice lobby, and I spend most of my time during the legislative session blogging at the Capitol. And I serve on the Religious Affairs and Legal Issues Subcommittee of the Governor's Task
Force. My name is Leo Treadway. I'm on the pastoral staff at St. Paul Reformation Lutheran Church in St. Paul. I serve as vice chair on the task force, and I chair the hearing and briefings of the Church.
And this is the first of 12 public hearings that we'll be having around the state of Minnesota. One of those will be in Minneapolis and one in St. Paul. All the rest of them are in Minneapolis.
Yes. What is the intent of the task force? Is this to hear problems or change legislation for this
month? Yes, we are trying to gather information about gays and lesbians in Minnesota and what kinds of discrimination they may have suffered. As a point of information, in the state of Minnesota, the Human Rights Act does not include sexual preference as a protected class. So as it is right now, unless you live in a town which has a local ordinance that gives gays and lesbians protection against discrimination, on the state level, there is none of that. So for instance, a gay person could be fired from a job just because he is a gay person and has no recourse. A gay person could be refused service in a restaurant, or could be refused health care, or could be denied rental of an apartment. Any of those kinds of things, just because of his sexual orientation or her sexual orientation at this time, unless you live in a city or a town where there is a local ordinance that would include this. So that is one of the concerns. What we are trying to do is to gather information, and we will be writing a report which we will submit to the legislature, and it will include some recommendations for improving the quality of life for gays and lesbians in the state of Minnesota.
Can I ask, if this law, if the human rights includes homosexual rights as protected by the law, would that mean, say, that if a religious school accepts public money, let's say for hot lunches, that they would be required to abide by the law, that they would have to hire a teacher who's qualified, even if it would be a practicing homosexual?
I'm not sure. At this time, as far as we know, there are no cases of that being the case. I mean, there has not been any kind of court ruling which says this is must-be.
Well, it's not a law yet, right? But if this would
be
a law.
No, but in other states, for instance, where it is, say like Wisconsin or Massachusetts, which have exclusive human rights law, That has not been the case.
But it could conceivably happen.
Anything could conceivably happen. I think that if you look at the laws that have been passed, either at the municipal, county, or state level, there is an exclusion related to religious institutions. In some cases, that is interpreted by the courts more broadly so as to include all paid employees of whatever status. In other settings, there has been some more narrow defining that says that that would include people whose direct work relates to the religious leadership of that group. For example, a pastor or a teacher of religious education, there are some questions whether that would include janitors, secretaries, that sort of thing.
So it's totally up in the air at this point.
It would be up to the legislature to decide what they would do with that, if anything. The tendency has been for there to be some exclusionary clause.
At this time, I would like to take the next speaker and perhaps we can continue this discussion at a later time.
My name is Patrick Gannon, G-A-N-N-O-N. I live at 639 23rd Street, Northeast in Rochester. My only affiliation is a citizen of the city of Rochester. I read the article in last Saturday's Post Bulletin that talked about these hearings and talked about the first thing I'd ever seen written about the gay community in Rochester. And I thought about testifying because some 20 years ago, I had a friend in college, a classmate, who came out while he was in college. And this was in a small liberal arts college and small community. And he was harassed terribly. And I learned a lot about courage as I saw what this man went through. And I guess I'd never really taken the opportunity to voice that opinion as a citizen, that no one should have to go through that kind of harassment. I guess it deeply offended me as a person. I felt his human rights were violated terribly. I understand our neighbor state of Wisconsin has a law that protects sexual orientation, and I was surprised to hear that Minnesota did not have such a law. I think I was hearing Reverend Treadway and asking the other minister about his colleagues and the way things are phrased in some of the religious circles, and I think that it's often talked about as a moral issue. And, it's my belief that it's really very much a human rights issue and a civil rights issue, not a moral issue. And that the moral argument confuses the issue quite a bit. And I think that there's a lot of fear and emotion when you get into all those moral arguments. And I think it clouds the issue terribly. I think that when I think of people in our society in 1990 being discriminated right in Rochester against them for employment, housing, education, based on their sexual orientation, you know, I think we're back in the dark ages. And I haven't seen it personally. I haven't lived in this community all that long. But the newspaper article certainly referred to that type of harassment. And again, I say it offended me 20 years ago, and it offends me today as well. In Rochester, currently, there's been a lot of attention to racial issues, and a lot of task force being formed to look at racial incidents and things like that. There's been a lot of community involvement in those types of things, and I see this as a very similar issue. And I only wish that there were as many people and as much attention to this hearing as there have been to those hearings. And I think it's a matter of misinformation on the public's part that there isn't more attention to these types of issues. I think people of color struggled with this and continue to struggle with these issues of human rights, even though the laws are on the books. And certainly people's sexual orientation is their own business. And I think these are real basic rights that are due all to all citizens. I would like to add my support to a comment that was made earlier about sexual orientation being included in sex education in public schools. And my understanding as I researched this a little bit is that there is, police departments are supposed to be given training. It's the law that they have to have training for anti-homophobic behavior. But I don't know if there's anything like that on the books for educators at this time. I would also add that if the situation occurred in the public schools like the woman had described, and I have no doubt that that was the case, that those people were reprimanded and reprimanded quickly. I think attitudes of high school teachers particularly are very important, and students are very, they're affected a lot by people. Those are the people they look up to. I don't testify a lot, so I'm kind of nervous. Right. And I'm close to the end of the page. And I guess I'd just like to end by saying that I strongly believe that when the rights of any segment of our community here in Rochester, when those rights are denied, then I think the rights of all of us are at risk, and that very much concerns me. In terms of the First Amendment rights and things like that, I think our society is very close to being chipping away at those rights, and it bothers me. And I also think that when anybody's experience of living is diminished in any way, then each of us is diminished. And I guess for the record, I'd like to say to all the people that would ever testify in the future that I believe that we all know gay men and lesbian women, and we just don't always know that that's what their sexual orientation is. And so those people would say, well, I don't know any gays or lesbians, I say, they're crazy. When I've seen people, like this fellow I knew in college, treated so differently one day because he said he was gay, where he had been accepted before that, I just find that offensive. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
Any questions?
I have a comment and observation. I'm sure that I would like to respond to you. Thank you for your testimony. Very well. I'm a little surprised that at the beginning of your testimony you argued that the moral issue probably should be put aside, and then I heard you close on what I thought was a fairly strong note of morality of the issues involved. It seems to me that the discussions about the morality of homosexuality and homosexual people has obsessed us for quite a while, with the morality of our actions towards them, particularly with regards to harassment, denial of human rights, violence, that sort of thing, is an aspect of the moral discussion which we seem to have not been taking time to serve. So we've had some reaction to that observation.
First thing I would say is yes, I definitely was closing on a moral tone, if you would say that. I think that if in fact the issue is going to be brought up in terms of morality, then we very definitely need to talk about it in terms of the morality of gay bashing and the violence and those types of things. If it's going to be discussed on that level, I would like to see it that it doesn't have to reach that level, because it's a basic human right and it's got nothing to do with the moral side of it can be over here. I think the human right and the civil right stands on its own, and that's what the law is involved with. And that's where I think the legislature and this commission, that's what the legislature can do. They can legislate civil and human rights. They can't legislate morality. They have no business doing it.
Can I have the list of the witnesses? And in the meantime, I would like to introduce David Bishop, legislator, the chief prosecutor.
No, I tried.